This is Hallie Morse. I'm here with Viney Burrows. It is Tuesday, December 20th, 2016. This is our third oral history of three. Viney, we'd like to hear a bit about history, your recollection of historical events that may have happened in your lifetime. Your telling of it, something that transpired that for you was sort of a monumental
event. It wasn't exactly monumental, but the assassination of John F. Kennedy happened when I was on tour with Earl Hyman in the Worlds of Shakespeare, which was there were selections from her book about Shakespeare. She often told me that she sent it to 99 publishers, and it was Putnam, the 100th publisher, who bought the book, and then it became a classic the world over. And she had taken vignettes, two roles for many of Shakespeare's plays, and put them together in what she called the Worlds of Shakespeare. And Earl Hyman and I did Antony and Cleopatra, and we did Troilus and Cressida, and many other roles, and I can't remember all of them. We did about five. We did some tragedies and some comedies. And we were on tour in Massachusetts, we learned a little before noon that President Kennedy had been shot. Earl and I were having lunch, and Earl said, we'll cancel the performance. Oh, I said, we can't do that. She says, yes, the president has been shot. I said, no, I was thinking of being paid, I'm sorry. So like crass.
Performer.
And of course, the producers did cancel the show. But that was my first reaction. And it was a momentous event in U.S. history, but I think my parochial and my personal response was not what one would expect from a patriot. But why should I consider myself a patriot? Let's get back to that, because that will lead to something else. Can you be an African-American and be a patriot, someone who loves this country? This country which treated African-Americans, black people, so shabbily, who kidnapped millions of us from Africa and brought us to these new lands to work as free labor. They enslaved us. And I like to use the verb. I don't like to call black people slaves. That's a noun. What was done to us was something active. We were kidnapped and we were enslaved, and it was our free labor at the start almost of the part of the Industrial Revolution brought this country into prominence and became a power in the world. It was our free labor as black people that... So I think that was part of why I couldn't or found it difficult hearing that John F. Kennedy had been assassinated, to feel that I was a patriot and the leader of my country had been assassinated. I would have a different feeling today. I think, you know, times have changed. Even with Trump as president, there are some things that he cannot destroy. And certainly the position of the role of the way black people are thought of, or African-related people are thought of nowadays, is different than it was, you know, in the 50s. And certainly different than what it was when we were in 1600, when we were brought here.
Do you remember where you were when Martin Luther King was assassinated?
No, I remember, interestingly enough, when FDR died, I was walking on 7th Avenue and a girl called Ruth Jett said, "They've killed him." I said, "Who are you talking about?" Ruth says, "President Roosevelt, he's dead." I said, "Oh, how did he die?" "Well, you know, he died of natural causes." But that was her initial response. They killed him. And he was, interestingly enough, I remember talking to Carolyn Barrow. She was the wife of Earl Barrow, who was the prime minister of Barbados and considered the father of their country because they gained their independence from Great Britain. They became part of the Commonwealth under his political rule. Carolyn often talked about the legacy of Lyndon Baines Johnson's and the Civil Rights Act. She had great respect for what he did. She did that picture of me when she was a portrait painter, and I was in Barbados with my mother. And that's a story. My mother was born in South Carolina. And, do I diverge all the time like this? Well, anyway, my mother was born in South Carolina. And she had a neighbor who was Mrs. Edwards, and who was from Barbados. And my mother's maiden name was Edwards. And when she retired from the ILGWU, my mother, she went on a tour that the ILGWU sponsored for retirees, and in it she visited several Caribbean islands.
So what does that stand for?
International Ladies Garment Workers Union. Uh-huh. A very important union at one time, less important today with manufacturing. All of that's now done in Malaysia and other places, but it was once a very powerful union. She went on a tour of the Caribbean islands, sponsored by the ILGWU, and she went to Jamaica, and she said the people were so angry all the time, and then she went to Trinidad, and she said the people were so happy all the time, and she went to Barbados, where Mrs. Edwards, our neighbor, was from, and the people were just right. They reminded her of what it was like growing up in South Carolina, I guess, like the turn of the century, because my mother was born in 1896.
Anyone else in your family performers?
No. No, not at all.
Just happened.
No. They were farmers. She was buried in Elliott, South Carolina, at a family cemetery that dated, I should really find out.
It's okay.
But it was very interesting. My mother's aunt, yes, her mother's mother. There were twin girls, came from Scotland. Don't know how they got to the South, but they were farm girls. One married a black man who was a farmer, and one married a white man who was a farmer, and they lived in neighboring towns. I should really go to and look up the census rolls. I just remember my uncle, who was very fair, and my grandmother, who was your color, and with your color hair, actually. And they were they visited each other in neighboring towns. If mother was in Elliott, South Carolina, whatever the neighboring town was, and there was no animosity, there was no strangeness, but it's interesting. And really, that's a story right there. These two girls from Scotland. Oh, did they marry? MacDonald was the name, and that's a Scottish name. So they lived in a common law marriage. Well,
not common for that time.
No. But so interesting. These two farm girls married two farmers. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe one of my grandchildren will investigate that story. But I can see my uncle now, who fought in the Spanish-American War in the Philippines, and he used to say the hill that they went up. I can't remember it now, but it was a famous hill in the Philippines.
So your daughter was just here, actually.
Yes.
She was just in the apartment and just left. Did you always want to be a mother? Did you know you wanted to?
Oh, yes. I was talking to someone the other day, and I don't know how it came up, but there was a choice I had to make recently, and I said, oh, I can't do it. And one of the reasons I have a one-woman show is because I wanted control of my life as a mother, that I could choose my work and I could choose when I could leave. And to do that, I had to be self-employed. There are many reasons for that, but the main reason that I stuck with it is that I could select the time that I could be away from my family. Now it could be the age. I'm certainly of a generation that considers being a wife and being a mother as the way one gains status, acceptance, approval as a woman. I often tell people now that I always knew I was black, but I didn't know I was a woman until that wave of, and I hate to use the word feminism, but until in the 70s, when there was so much emphasis on the status and condition of women, that I always knew I was black, but it wasn't until that surge of looking at the role of women did I realize I was a woman. And I suffered because I was a woman. I suffered because I was black, and I suffered because I was a woman. I was in double jeopardy, and because I was poor, I was in triple jeopardy. And now I could say that I'm an old black woman, so I've got a triple whammy, or maybe even a treble or quadruple whammy, though.
So in what ways would you say that you were troubled from this? You know, what obstacles did it present in your life? And in your career?
Well, just even think of being an actress, and the reason why I decided on the one-woman shows, and it came to me when I was in Germany and was received so well by a German audience in a Thornton Wilder play, a wonderful role of a the older daughter visiting her family at a holiday, a family holiday. It was a very poignant scene, and I remember getting applause when I left the stage. And I said, Lillian Gish and I shared a dressing room, and I said, I have to come so far to have a role that I considered a true depiction of a human being. It's not a Dies Demandos role, you know, just an ordinary young woman visiting her family I said, my mother wanted me to be a lawyer, and she was right. There is no role for me in theater. I cannot do what I want to do in theater. So Lillian Gish, she said, well, you have great talent, and you just have to find a way to use your talent, which was easy enough for her to say, but I said, well, I shall find a way. And that's how I really came to the idea of doing one-woman shows. And the first ones, of course, were just the roles of females from classical literature, from dramatic literature, starting with Alice in Wonderland and Juliet and on to an ending with an old Irish woman.
And you are about to do another Shakespeare.
Yes, soon. Interestingly enough, the public is having a reading of A Midsummer Night's Dream, an all-day reading, and I have a small part, though as I love to say there, because that's what I was taught, there's no such thing as a small part. There are only small actors. So I'm anxious, and I've been reading so many versions of Midsummer Night's Dream, and it's just absolutely fascinating to do that. It's a very complex story, and you have to, you know who all the characters are and what their involvement is, but a charming, charming, charming play. And Lea de Bessonnet, whom I adore, she directed me in Good Person of Sichuan, and so it will be nice to work with her, and I don't know what they're going to do with it. I have the feeling they probably want to see whether it could possibly be a summer production, and so they will here have the reading and all the other designers, costume and lights and sound, and all will be part of it, and Lea will decide. So I'm looking forward to that.
Always good to do the classics.
Well, I think the classics, you know, and Shakespeare particularly, and Brecht, who's not a classicist at all, but just a great playwright and a great writer who understood the human condition and the human drives and the human feelings. And he is like Shakespeare in that respect. I used to say, I can do any role. I used to say that. Because it is the role of the artist to illuminate the human condition for the audience, and that means creating an illusion. And if you are any kind of an artist, you'll do that, and then the audience will see whoever you want them to see, because you will be whom you are supposed to be. I am so enchanted by the fact that we have now, coming to the American stage, so many African and British actors of color who have been trained in the classic tradition, I mean, to use the voice and the body as the instrument. And in a way that I don't think we find the same kind of emphasis in U.S. theater education. It's no accident that we have actors of color. I haven't seen Othello. Have you seen it yet?
I have not.
Yeah.
Really want to see it.
But I've seen on television and I have seen on stage British-born black actors who create the illusion. And it's very exciting that their color does not matter because their persona as a human being they represent is there in front of me. So that their color doesn't matter. I just see who they are supposed to be. And it's just, you know, really very, very exciting.
Hmm.
I think that they are teaching the American-born actor of color some good lessons. But now let's go on to the next one. Ask me another question.
Now I'm curious. Okay. Are there TV or film actresses or actors that, you know, inspired you or continue to inspire you? It can be someone older or younger, but I'm just curious, you know, a couple people that just really you were a fan of.
I cannot call names. I know when I see someone that I like, I see them on film or I see them on stage.
And that's just like someone who really sort of influenced you and your artistry. And if there isn't anyone, it's okay too. I'm just curious.
No woman comes to mind, though I have seen productions. I've seen productions at the Public, Shakespearean classic, and I have admired the actors, but don't see them enough to call out the names. But they have been British and African diasporan. No, but certainly not. Maybe I shouldn't even say that. I have not been so taken by American actors, American female actors. Oh, I love Viola Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I really do. I love her as a film actor. Now I'm going into ticklish territory, trying to do that. I'll have to leave that for my memoir.
Okay. Viney, if you couldn't have been an actress for whatever reason, if you had to do something else, what would you be?
I think I would have probably taken my mother's advice and become a lawyer, a civil rights lawyer, a human rights lawyer, a journalist, a politician, because I think the artist affects change, but I think those who work as as attorneys, as human rights lawyers, also affect change. I think it's important to leave this world, as Paul Robeson said, you know, I elect to fight for freedom and liberty.
Interesting that your work sort of in a way did that. You were your own, you know, a storyteller, surely, but it's almost as if you were, you know, arguing a case, so to speak, you know.
I remember being in at a school in Minnesota, and they had a dinner for me, and someone said at the table, I think it was the president of McAllister College, said, "You are an evangelist." Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter what name you are called. As when I step on the stage, if I become a human being with emotions and feelings that you recognize in the audience, and if that makes clear to the audience what he or she is about, then I've done my part. You know, art is long and time is fleeting, and you never actually ever fully are satisfied with what you do. You just try. You try, and it's that intensity, and it's that truth, that veracity, that I hope the audience recognizes. You know, I don't like to pontificate, but I take what I do very seriously. And at the end, you have to, I'm an artist, I'm a human being, you have to stand for something, or else you're worth nothing. That's it.
Would you say you're a religious person?
Spiritual, but not religious. I think of religion maybe as dogma. No, and I'm not that, I don't think. No.
I didn't go to church.
Oh, I go to church. I go to St. Mark's, and I like being there. It's a community of people who think alike about the world and want to make it a better place. And we're all flawed, but we try. That's all we can do. So, and then you can choose where you want to go with that community, but I choose them, and so I stay with them. When I was much younger, when my children were younger, I used to go to Friends, the Quaker church, because it was the only place where I had quiet for 30 minutes.
I'm sure.
I guess that's it. I don't know. If you have another question to ask me, I can't think of anything else that I...
Well, you know, this is something, you know, archival for people to listen to and to learn from. Would you say you've got any, and this is sort of a touchy subject, but any regrets?
They Oh, that's a hard one because you can't go back and it's so useless.
Well, it's not, you know, it's not for those who are listening, you know. It's a teaching moment, if you will.
Well, I can't go back, and someone used to say, you can't go back because I wouldn't have the strength to do it over again.
Right.
You know, so you just plow on and do the best you can every step of the way, and I think your steps do get more certain the older you grow. There are, yeah, there are
a stronger resolve.
Yes, I think so. I used to say, and I don't say it anymore, and that may say something about the United States that we live in. Talking about white people, I would say, could I run to this person if I were fleeing from a lynch mob? Would they let me in? We don't have to think about lynch mobs the way we did when I was a girl. When the whole question of Jim Crow and the Ku Klux Klan and the chain gangs and the rampant discrimination against black people, I was at the hospital. I guess, well, I was at the hospital earlier today, but I often look at the hospital now and different hospitals, and I think of the hospital unions, local 1199 particularly, and what it meant to have a union that fought for decent wages and benefits and brought people into the middle class from rank poverty so that they could buy a home and send their children to college and move up into what normally white people can move up into, the middle class status. Well, that has happened to black people. We move into the middle class, we move into the presidency of the United States of America. And to positions of power and significance in government and in the corporate world. And hopefully they will take the memory of where we have been to enable even more people to move into the middle class so that all people, all children will have a decent education and will have adequate housing and health care. That is what we want for all people, all children, to be able to reach their highest potential, whatever it is, you know. And we all have limitations, but we should be able to fulfill our potential. That's all we ask, the opportunity to do that for all children, all over the world, not just in the United States. One of the reasons I am so troubled by President-elect Trump is looking at those members of his cabinet who I am fearful will turn back the clock and erode some of the gains we have made as human beings in this country. And it's a real threat, I think, and it's a real fear. And I'm so happy when I hear resistance and protests still, because we're in the hard times. Sylvester Stallone, any National Endowment for the Arts? Well, we shall see. And Sessions, Attorney General, we shall see. And we survive. We've survived worse, so we'll come through this. I'm sure of it. And the artists will lead the way, and young people will lead the way.
What have you not done that you still want to do?
Oh, I do want to write. I really do want to write.
What would you write?
Well, I think I really want to start with my own life.
A memoir.
And find out about those two girls from Scotland. One who married a black farmer and one who married a white farmer. Yes. And lived in neighboring towns. What a story that is, you know.
Oh, you should definitely write a memoir.
And, yes, that's it. I think that's the end. Oh, not the end, it's just another... Oh, there is never an end. There's just new beginnings.
Yes, new beginnings. I just have to say, I'm in your living room, and there are books everywhere.
Yes.
So many books. You must read a ton.
Yes, I was an omnivorous reader as a child.
Do you read plays often?
Yes, I read plays. I read novels. I read biographies. I'm now fascinated by biographies. It's a glimpse of another world. I was listening to Tavis Smiley last night, and he was talking to the artist, the graphic artist, David Hockney, and I found that fascinating. And the other week he was talking to Charles Pride, the black country singer. And I remember that my husband, who was from Iowa, loved country music. Loved country music and loved Mozart. He and his brother. Who would imagine it?
Different strokes.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Viney.
Well, thank you. It's been a joy and a pleasure to know you. You are the epitome of youth on the move.
Well, thank you so
beautiful
very much.
Beautiful and open.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.